If it's Tuesday, it must be the United Nations. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on a jam-packed week, President Obama met today with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, individually and together. The first time Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu have met since Netanyahu took office in March. Obama urged them to do more to make Mideast peace talks possible.
Despite all the obstacles, despite all the history, despite all the mistrust, we have to find a way forward. We have to summon the will to break the deadlock that has trapped generations of Israelis and Palestinians in an endless cycle of conflict and suffering. We cannot continue the same pattern of taking tentative steps forward and then stepping back. Success depends on all sides acting with a sense of urgency. And that is why I've asked Secretary Clinton and Senator Mitchell to carry forward the work that we do here today.
Earlier today, Obama addressed the UN's summit on climate change and said the U.S. has done more in the last 8 months to reduce carbon pollution than it has at any time in history and won't stop.
There should be no illusions that the hardest part of our journey is in front of us. We seek sweeping but necessary change in the midst of a global recession, where every nation's most immediate priority is reviving their economy and putting their people back to work.
Well, the BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus covered the president's morning address on climate change. He joins us on the line. And Jonathan, there was a lot of international anticipation. Obama is expected to be more open to issues like emissions controls than George Bush was. But as he said, the country is in a recession. So did he say today what people wanted to hear?
Well, it was not a particularly precise speech in the sense that there were no figures or anything like that. Of course, the important thing to realise is that this isn't a negotiation here at the UN today. It's merely an effort to try and give some energy, some impetus to the talks that everybody hopes will produce a treaty by the end of the year in Copenhagen. I think the important thing was, though, he stressed that the historic recognition of the United States for the role it has to play. He was determined, he said, to act. And he said America would meet its historic responsibility to future generations.
Was there a little bit of a smackdown with China aspect to this? Because the president, as we said, is meeting with the Chinese president. And there's been some grumbling in Congress that China is doing less than the U.S. is. But today, China also made some pledges.
Well, indeed, I think President Hu Jintao of China's speech was in some ways the one that most people were looking to see some sign of significant shift in China's position. Again, no specific figures, but he did say that China would intensify its efforts to conserve energy and improve energy efficiency. And importantly, he noted that China would endeavour to cut its carbon dioxide emissions by what he called a notable margin by 2020 from the 2005 level. So that's, in a sense, the two sides are signalling to each other. And America and China are really the two key players in all of this. As the largest emitters of global gases, global warming gases, their role is crucial. America, a developed society, China, the key developing society. So it's interesting because it's just like with the world economy in some ways. Right. It's that relationship between Washington and Beijing, which is absolutely crucial.
Well, we just have about a minute, but we want to ask you about Iran's President Ahmadinejad, who's going to address the assembly on Thursday. He's been making a lot of noise ahead of that, again, denying the Holocaust, saying that he's glad that he made people angry by denying the Holocaust. What's the sense of, you know, what his impact is going to be?
Well, look, the UN General Assembly is a moment for great diplomatic and political theatre, and the Iranian president is, if you like, one of the star actors, one of the people that people will be watching most closely. I think everybody expects him to say pretty much the kind of things that they would expect him to say. I think that we've had a foretaste of it in his comments already. Of course, what really matters is the negotiations that are going to be taking place at the start of October, which will involve the United States with the Iranians, a number of other key players, the Europeans and the Russians. So this is all preliminary to that. Remember, this was going to be a summit where there was going to be talk of serious sanctions against Iran. That's been postponed for now. The key thing is whether any progress can be made in October.
The BBC's Jonathan Marcus. Thank you so much.
Thanks now.
Well, we want to spend a few minutes today on electronic books and schools. just a passing fad or the future? Cushing Academy, a prep school in Ashburnham, Massachusetts, is betting on the latter. They're replacing 20,000 library books with electronic books and converting the library into an interactive media center where kids will wander through web pages of titles instead of stacks. It's caused a firestorm. The American Association of School Librarians wrote to say libraries are built over time and that reading online doesn't focus the mind the way a book does. But Dr. James Tracy, the headmaster at Cushing Academy, told the Boston Globe, "When I look at books, I see an outdated technology like scrolls before books." Dr. Tracy joins us in the studio. First of all, you say you're going to hire even more librarians to help kids navigate this online library, but address the criticism that kids are going to lose that lovely tactile experience of holding a book.
Well, I certainly love books. My home, my office is lined with print books. What's interesting to me is that the new generation of younger people are finding their own aesthetic in the electronic world. And we don't view this as pro-book or anti-book. Our view of it is that the headline should read, "Prestigious prep school expands its library from 20,000 volumes to 5 million volumes."
But you are taking away the paper product to a large extent. You're keeping some rare books and such, and you're giving the books away to other schools.
Yes, no books are being thrown out. They're all being distributed to faculty around campus. They had the first choice, then the rest were given away. But you're quite right that we are going largely printless in the library.
Just stay on the emotional portion of this, because there is an emotional portion. In fact, we heard from one of your former students. He happens to be a friend of the program, Robert Young, who you know was a student. And he wrote and he said, "My first reaction was horror. I had learned to read in those libraries. I have an emotional attachment to the library." React first to that emotional part of the equation, that people have an emotional attachment to books.
Well, I think that's entirely salutary. I think it's wonderful that people love books, and we are certainly not anti-print books at Cushing. To us, it's just a matter of how you deliver the book. It's a book is just a device. It's a 15th century technology. I'm sure that Cicero had wonderful experiences of first encountering Plato in scrolls and always associated that wonderment of discovery with the scroll in his hand. And so for those of us who were raised on printed books, we of course see them as sacred temples. The fact is that the students of today are entirely adept, facile, and comfortable with electronic technology, and they are voting with their feet and their hands and their eyes.
Well, that's what your former student goes on to say. His first reaction was horror, but then he realized that these 20,000 books were not being read.
Absolutely not. We did a study. We found that of the 20,000 volumes in our library, only 48 on average were out on any given day, and more than 30 of those were children's books. We have faculty who live on campus. We then asked the students, "Well, perhaps you're doing research with the books, but just not circulating the books." And we found almost uniformly that they said, "Well, no, I'm not doing much research there. I'm going online." The faculty corroborated that. They said that they're getting a lot of student papers that are citing Wikipedia or worse sources, blogs and so forth.
Right.
And so what we feel is that if that's where they're going, then we want to provide them with the tools to really be successful.
And the better information.
Absolutely. So by creating access to databases that allow them to search peer-reviewed journals, we have a teaching opportunity to show them the skill sets that they need to separate the wheat from the chaff in this enormous library of information on the Internet.
Well, and it's an enormous capital investment. Tell us, first of all, we understand you're building a $500,000 learning center. You're going to be spending $42,000 on flat-screen TVs that'll project data from the Internet, $20,000 on special laptop-friendly study carrels, but also giving Kindle books to the kids. Now, Kindle books are e-readers. You can read books on them. But we thought you had to pay to download the information. So how does that work?
There's a great deal that is available for free now through Google and Gutenberg and many other sources. So essentially, any books that are past copyright are effectively available for free. In addition, of course, you do need to pay for books that are still contemporary and are under copyright, but you have to pay for those books if you want to shelve them in your library anyway. We actually find that it's cheaper to go with the electronic book. We typically would spend $30 for a hardcover. We're typically spending about $20 for an e-book access, and we get six copies simultaneously, so we're able to give them to six different Kindle users.
Well, this is where our question is, because we understand you've purchased 18 of the Kindles.
Yes.
And you've got 450 students.
That has caused a great deal of misapprehension. First of all, for many years now, we've been an entirely laptop school. Every student comes to every class with a laptop that has Wi-Fi access to the Internet everywhere they go on campus. students are on financial aid, we provide those free of charge to them. So by creating this plethora of online resources that are available electronically to the students, effectively, the largest library in human history travels with them everywhere they go on campus. And what we're trying to ascertain is what will be the demand for the Kindle type of reader. We're beginning with 18. I would be happy to buy 450 for all 450 of our students if the demand is there.
What do you do if you have the one student at Cushing who says, you know, I want to hold in my hand Sir Gawain and the Green Knight or whatever it is. I want to have it in my hand.
Well, absolutely. In fact, this is a decision about our library, but many teachers are still ordering their textbooks. It's a local option in the class. If I look out my window across the campus and see a student sitting under a tree reading Chaucer, it is utterly immaterial to me whether she or he is using a Kindle or a paperback. I'm delighted to see them reading Chaucer.
Well, what do you say to people who say, well, that's fine for you. You're going to put a cappuccino maker, much has been made of that, in this new media center. And schools can't replicate this. They can barely keep a book in the library, much less go to this expensive high-tech version of books.
There's truth in the sense that we are an affluent and privileged school. What we are committed to at Cushing is to use that privilege to be able to help all of the other schools in the country. Everything that we are doing, from the curricular to the technological innovation, is designed to be shared as freeware on our internet and in any other venue possible to help to leaven education at the secondary level all over the world. I love print books, and there is certainly an aesthetic that is distinctive to print books. When I was 18 years old, I was actually a working-class kid who had dropped out of high school. I was married with a young child and working in a factory. I was at the beach one day with my wife and young son and grew very frustrated with the fact that as I looked out at all the myriad gradations of blue in the water and in the sky, I really didn't have the lexicon to describe the subtle gradation. So I asked my wife to watch our son while I went to town, not knowing exactly what I was seeking. I ended up coming out of a bookstore with a thesaurus and went back to the beach and sat down looking up the word blue and saw words like azure and cerulean, which were entirely unfamiliar to me, but I determined to make the entire English language my birthright on that day. And subsequent to that, I went on to get my GED and then worked my way through the University of Massachusetts at Boston and eventually got my master's degree and PhD from Stanford and two more graduate degrees from Boston University. I feel that the world of information that was available through printed books at that time made that possible for me and gave me that epiphany.
It was a book.
Yes.
On a beach day.
Absolutely. And what I find terribly exciting is that every student in the world soon will be able to hold in the palm of their hand the equivalent of the Library of Congress. And that's from Boston to Bangalore.
That's Dr. James Tracy, whose life, as we just heard, was transformed by a book. And now as headmaster at Cushing Academy in Ashburnham, Massachusetts, he's hoping to transform other lives with e-books. Dr. Tracy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, just ahead, we're going to go from high school library books to college textbooks. Several colleges are going digital, but is this just the industry selling something new? And later, the mathematician who won a genius grant for... Well, for actually watching paint dry, but he sees what no one else does, as you'll hear. We'll be back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Our conversation today is about e-books. Will this be a watershed year for e-textbooks? This year, the major college textbook publishers released half of their titles in digital format, and they come with some bells and whistles. This isn't just a book online. Some have software that automatically grades homework, lets students share their notes, or links a professor's taped lecture right to the online textbook. Jeff Young covers technology for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Jeff, there's also a convergence at work here. The publishers are offering these titles while schools are testing out the concept.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big year for electronic textbooks on campuses. Two things. One is the availability. As you mentioned, there are just so many more titles available this year than in the past. It's over 7,000 titles that you can get in electronic form this year. And the other is awareness, with some hype recently around Kindle and some other e-readers announcing textbook-friendly projects. There's a little bit more awareness by college students, I think, that they can do this. And so this is going to be a test year, I think, to see whether whether students try them and then whether they like them.
Well, and we know there are seven colleges participating in an e-textbook experiment. It's supported by Amazon. Arizona State's one of the schools. What are the other schools?
Princeton and Pace University and Reed College. So it's a mix of schools.
Right. And there's a company, CourseSmart, which was started by major textbook publishers to sell their electronic version. It's sort of coming through that one pipeline of that company. But how do the e-textbooks work? How does a student get them? What can they do with them?
The way that most students will end up trying an electronic textbook for the first time will be through a system like CourseSmart, which you mentioned, an attempt by the major textbook publishers to kind of start their own, what they hope will be kind of like an iTunes music store for textbooks. And then these books that you would buy through that store would be downloaded to your laptop or your desktop computer. Most of the textbook publishers offer a way so you can read offline. You don't have to be connected to the internet to read it.
Well,
and then the other way to read electronic textbooks, which is sort of the push this year, as you mentioned, by Kindle and other e-reader. These are machines that are dedicated to reading books. Sony Reader is another one. And the benefit of those books, according to the producers, is that they have a screen that is much easier on the eyes. The e-reader raises the question of, okay, will students fork over the money, which can be hundreds of dollars for some of these e-readers, even if the price of the electronic versions are cheaper?
Can you just give me a cost comparison, your average textbook and your average e-book?
On average, e-textbooks are about half the price of a printed textbook, but there are exceptions, and there are some publishers or in some cases on some of the e-readers where the discount is even deeper, because right now price is really the big selling point, especially with the economy the way it is and the price of college continuing to go up.
Well, that raises another question. How much is this driven by the demand on this part of professors and students, and how much is it driven by the industry, which really stands to benefit? It gets to sell new technology, and it gets to cut off this loss of revenues that occurs when students buy books and then resell their books, because we understand that some of these downloaded books will self-destruct. In other words, they won't last. They can't be resold. So how much is this being driven by an industry that just wants kids to spend more money?
That's definitely a very good question. And it's hard to know whether it's simply because they want to maximize revenue. I guess their model is to do that. Or if they're trying to respond to a demand. But it is true that on the CourseSmart model, they do self-destruct, that sort of Mission Impossible model there. But they have a timeout sort of after 180 days is the average. So you're renting the book, so to speak, even though they don't say it that way.
Right.
And that will eliminate, if it catches on, the secondary market. So the idea of buying a used textbook could go away.
You mentioned that some of the companies are offering technology that will capture a professor's lecture so that he can just have students download that. We know many students today, don't know a world before computers. But then there are other professors. How are professors feeling about the technology? For instance, can you tell a student to go to page 20? Everybody turn to page 20.
The biggest concern I heard from professors was that turn to the page 200. And it is a little awkward in the current Kindle because they don't have page numbers. Because you can adjust the type size, which is, a benefit. You can make the type huge or you can make it small. And because of that, there aren't fixed numbers. It's sort of a location number, they call it. The students say that you get used to it. It's sort of not a deal breaker for them. The most common benefit I heard from professors was they feel like they were sort of on the cutting edge and they wanted to get their students to use new devices that might be part of a future workplace.
So there's that advantage for students. What are other advantages? Because the concerns were, you can't write in the margins. It's not like a book. It's not tactile. It's not easy for a professor to say, class, please open to page 120. So what are some of the new e-books doing to overcome those problems?
These electronic versions have, in many cases now, they do have some features to allow you to highlight and allow you to do some things you maybe couldn't do before, like search the book, which we all know from online searches can be really useful. So you can just jump right to a part of the text that way. And you can maybe share your notes with others.
And you can take notes on some of
these. You can take notes. In almost all of the versions that are out now, even on the e-reader devices, there are ways to put notes into the book and save those notes for yourself and even export them out so that you can paste them into your Word document or your paper.
Well, and what do you think? How do you think this is going to play out? Are there going to always be students who want or even need? Not every student has a laptop right now. So are there always going to be students who want or need to have the tactile paper in their hand, and what are some publishing companies doing to sort of include them as well?
There's a smaller company called Flat World Knowledge that is basically giving away its books. It only has a few books right now, but it's making a sort of open textbook project. But what they're doing is they're allowing the option for students who want, they can pay $30 and get a black and white printed edition of the book, but they don't have to. It can be a free ebook. It might evolve that students end up buying both, or that there's sort of a mixed use out there where some things are online and some things are in print.
Jeff Young covers technology for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He's speaking to us about the rise of electronic textbooks on college campuses. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, Pittsburgh readies for the G20, thousands of workers getting ready to telecommute, some store owners getting ready to sell their wares on the street, and of course, other Pittsburghers writing haikus. We'll hear about the G20 haiku contest. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, heavy metal on acoustic guitars. The latest news is first, Here and Now. Those heavy rains and the floods they caused in the southeast over the past few days are receding somewhat, leaving behind washed-out roads and bridges, closed schools. They've also claimed the lives of 8 people. A toddler in a mobile home west of Atlanta was swept away in the raging waters of a creek, and a 15-year-old boy drowned in the small town of Tryon in the northwest corner of Georgia, where about 300 people evacuated their homes after the Chattooga River spilled its banks. Benjamin Perry is mayor of Tryon. Mayor Perry, so sorry to hear about the 15-year-old drowning there. And we'd heard that people were trying to shore up the levee. What happened to the river?
Well, it breached that levee yesterday. We had folks putting sandbags on there, but it still breached the levee.
Yeah. We're hearing about 20 inches of rain. What's happening in the town?
Well, there's places in town that it probably went waist high.
In the street?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I had to close several streets. Of course, there's several houses got water in them. Town hall, we just had put new carpet in this at our town hall.
Well, that's too bad. But, of course, the loss of life and the people inconvenienced is the biggest concern. Where are you putting people? Where are they going?
Red Cross had a place set up in the Methodist Church. I guess it wasn't quite big enough that they moved it down to the Pentecostal Church.
Well, and we understand rescue workers were doing everything they could, improvising to try to save people, jet skis, boats, ropes, ladders.
Right.
What are you hearing from your personnel there?
Well, our police department has just about worked around the clock. And we've had a lot of help from neighboring towns, their police department. They've sent folks up here to help us direct traffic and block off streets.
Have you ever seen it this bad?
Oh, yeah.
When's that?
In 1990, it was this bad. Probably worse.
Well, and what do you do then if you built a levee and the levee didn't hold?
It didn't break. It just ran over.
Well, then, so what do you do? Do you have to build a bigger levee?
Well, I don't know what's going to take place. That's the first time that I know of that it's went over this levee.
Yeah. Well, meantime, we're reading other stories from the South. There's a man in Tennessee who made a bet that he could swim in the ditch across from his house, and he hasn't been heard from. A poor little baby in a mobile home was swept away right out of his parents' arms. Other people in cars, you know, thinking they can run through areas, and then their cars get swept away. What are you telling people?
Well, what we're telling them is not to drink the water. Our water supply comes from a spring, and the water is more like a chocolate-colored water right now.
Oh, boy.
We advise them not to use water in any way, taking a bath or drinking it, and just to be careful. We closed the bridge here that goes over to our big industry here. And
which is what? What's the industry?
Mount Vernon Mills.
Well, is that going to be threatened?
Yeah, they're not running. They're shipping, but they're not producing anything.
Well, how long do you think it'll be before the town is back on its feet?
Well, it depends on the weather. It's raining outside right now. If it doesn't get too bad, we'll have some semblance of regularity, I'd say, by tomorrow.
I hope so.
We're having to wash the mud out of the buildings. And It's just about destroyed the central office for the school. It's more near the river than our office is.
Well, and of course you have to have at least one funeral. That's Benjamin Perry, mayor of the small town of Tryon in northwest Georgia, hit hard by the heavy rain we're seeing in the south. Mayor Perry, we wish you well.
Thank you.
And by the way, Georgia's Department of Transportation says that across the state, they're doing more water rescues today than yesterday because drivers are going around the barricades that have been put up around unsafe areas. Also, the Army Corps of Engineers says that Lake Lanier near Atlanta has risen more than 3 feet in recent days, but it's still below normal levels. Just 6 months ago, Georgia's three-year drought was declared over. The National Weather Service says there's more rain to come, but it will unlikely be as severe. We'll be back in just 30 seconds, here and now. The MacArthur Fellowship's Genius Awards were announced today. We didn't get any again. But among the 24 winners is Harvard mathematician El Mahadevan. He does, well, it's hard to say what he does. We spoke with him last year about everything from how paint dries to why flags flutter. We want to replay that for you. But first, reaction from the professor. Professor, congratulations. And do you feel different now that you're a certified genius?
I certainly know one thing. I'm not a genius. And I feel odd. I was very surprised when I got this phone call last week. I still am in a state of shock. It still hasn't sunk in.
Right. You don't quite know what it's going to mean for you.
No.
Well, it definitely means $500,000 cash award to be applied in any way you want to apply it. Do you know what you might do with that?
It would be nice to do something for education, but at this primary and the secondary school level, because in some sense this is a recognition that it's good and it's fine to be curious and curious about everything, and what better place to instill and inculcate and encourage that curiosity than among the young.
Well, in giving you the award, the McCarthy Committee said the unusually broad scope of his theoretical and experimental investigations defies facile characterization, but they are linked by an effort to discover the geometric and mechanical principles that determine the behavior of complex biology and physical systems. Is that about right?
Yes. I mean, it's a little over the top.
Well, Professor, congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
And let's hear, in his own words, what Harvard professor of applied mathematics El Mahadevan does. When we spoke with him, he was watching paint dry to see how it cracks, and we asked, what questions does he ask while he does that?
So, from a physical, mathematical perspective, one might ask, what are the conditions that actually lead to cracking? Sometimes it causes wrinkles instead of cracks. Can you predict what the distance between cracks is, for example? Can you control it? Because if I can control it, maybe I can do something beautiful.
Did you literally sit and watch paint dry?
I have done that.
I have seen paint dry, and it forms a skin, and
exactly.
Then there's like a bubble underneath it.
That's right.
And so why is it important to know that a drop of paint will form a skin and then have a bubble underneath it that then dries?
I didn't say it was important.
But wait a minute, you're with Harvard. It's got to be important.
No. I think of these questions as being part of a continuum. You can ask questions about everything. One, as a child, does that. I mean, you start out by being curious. You can be curious about things which you can't touch, which you cannot see, things very far away. But you can also be curious about things in front of you.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind my using the analogy to a child, you're born and you have a very limited number of observations that you've made initially, none when you were in your mother's womb. You come out and you start making observations about the world and you try to make sense of it. And the way you try to make sense of it and say, well, this is like this. So you're using analogy all the time. And you can do the same thing in science.
Can you give me an example in layman's terms of something that you observed in nature and asked a why about it and how that led you down some other path?
So the problem of studying wrinkles on skin is, I think, an example of that. I found that we could make a theory for this. I made a very simple model which explains, for example, the size of the wrinkle as a function of various parameters. And I realized that these wrinkles appear in many other places. I'm not the first one, but I started looking around. And you start looking at the Earth. So now you start to see patterns. You see mountains. And one can ask, are these mountains also wrinkled, but on a very large scale? And you realize maybe they are. And so we go the other way also. So I went from wrinkles on skin to wrinkles on tiny little tubes, the kinds of tubes that people now talk a lot about, carbon nanotubes. And you see the same thing happening. And then you ask if that same thing's happening on the scale of the Earth, and it's also happening on the scale of my hands, and it's also happening on the scale of this very, very tiny object, is there some general feature? And, you know, as scientists, we want to collapse as much explanation as we possibly can into something fairly simple that relates all these different pieces together.
And what do you learn about wrinkles from that?
Well, okay, so the mountain story is still very much a work in progress. But at the level of these very tiny tubes and at the level of skin, we learn that we can actually predict the sizes of the wrinkles, the shapes of the wrinkles. What good does that do you? I don't know. I mean, it satisfies an innate curiosity in me, certainly. It amuses a lot of my friends.
Can you just, for us now, just tick through some of the why questions that you've had? I mean, just, you know, think about the things you've looked at and just said, why does that do that?
Okay, yeah. How do fish swim? So can we predict the speed of a fish if we knew its size, if we knew how the muscles were essentially operating inside it? A particular analogy, which I like to make often, is an analogy between a fish where the fish has little wiggles which move on along it and then cause the fish to move. And a different version of the same problem, almost the same problem, is if I had a flow past a static object, like a flag, then the flag starts to wiggle.
Mm-hmm.
So are there similarities in these two problems? Naively, you would say, there's nothing in common. You know, a fish is active, it's actually consuming energy and swimming through water. A flag is essentially fluttering in the breeze. But it turns out, mathematically, that the way you would think about both these is actually fairly closely related. And we'd previously worked on how flags flutter, and now we've used some of that knowledge to try and understand how fish might swim.
So are you saying, because if I remember from reading about your flag work, the wind that's blowing along a flag is making the flag oscillate.
Correct.
So are you saying that rather than the fish wiggling, the water passing by it is making it oscillate?
Well, it's a combination.
Yeah.
So the fish would start to wiggle, and once the fish wiggled, the water would start to move, and then the water pushes back on the fish. And this combination of the fish moving the water and the water pushing back on the fish then actually makes the fish move in a particular direction.
Hmm. And we can go from there to how do snakes come out of water and wiggle along on land? And
exactly.
Yeah.
And then ask questions sort of if you wanted to zoom out. So we look at a fish, we look at a snail, we look at a snake. Are there general principles?
Huh.
Maybe you will see a pattern. Maybe we won't. I don't know. I don't know the answer. I mean, the greatest part of being able to pursue this way of living, literally, is that I don't know what will happen tomorrow. I have a little sort of favorite quote of mine, if I might.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it goes back to Samuel Johnson, the famous English lexicographer. Vulgar and inactive minds confound familiarity with knowledge. And everything that we see for some time in our lives is going to be for the first time. And Johnson sort of hit that on the head. There's one other, which is a wonderful quote, due to a very famous physiologist, Albert St. George. And he said that a discovery is seeing what everybody has seen, but thinking what nobody has thought.
That's Lakshmi Narayanan Mahadevan, professor of applied mathematics at Harvard University. Pretty much his profession is to ask why. Professor, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Welcome back to Here and Now. If you play the video game, you might want to get some real-life guitar heroes. Take, for instance, Rodrigo and Gabriela. They've been playing together for 15 years, first in a heavy metal band in their native Mexico City, later as street buskers in Dublin and Copenhagen, always paying tribute to the music they grew up listening to.
Mm-hmm.
That's Rodrigo and Gabriela's version of Stairway to Heaven. It's from an earlier CD. Their new record is called 1111, and they join us with their acoustic guitars from the NPR studios in New York. Gabriela, we'll start with you. To begin, we heard Hanuman. You dedicate that song to Carlos Santana. And each of the 11 tracks on the new CD is dedicated to a musician that inspired you?
Yes, yes. We choose them among hundreds. We have a lot of, incredible musicians we worship, and we are not academically trained. So they were our teachers.
Well, let's listen to another song. This is Logos from the new CD 1111. Now, who inspired this?
Aldi Meola. Aldi Meola, jazz guitarist, coming as well from the rock world. A good friend of ours as well.
Let's listen. A little bit about how you play together, Rodrigo playing lead, Gabriela rhythm. How do you play off each other, Gabriela?
Well, we all the time our really proposal is to blend the sound of the two guitars into one, just make a unity, and we try to blend the sounds. So the result is like a rock band, even though that we do not sing. It is still very, the structure of the pieces, they go to rock.
Well, we're sort of hearing, your guitars there. They're sort of echoing your words. As long as you have them, let's hear a little of Buster Voodoo. This is the Jimi Hendrix tribute on the new CD 1111.
The idea of adding these 11 artists was to introduce this music to people that potentially, being our fans, we believe they are going to like it. People like Michel Camilo, jazz pianist, which is, we believe has been highly influential in our music. We think is important as a musicians that we promote good music as well, and that way we divert, the attention from us to another artist that are worth it as well,
Well, and you're not only influenced by these artists, some others, Carlos Santana, his music is reflected in one of the cuts, but you're joined by one of the artists on the song At Man, which is dedicated to yet another artist. Terrible story of the player known as Dimebag Darrell. Tell us about that story, first of all.
Dimebag was one of the great guitarists from the metal world, and unfortunately he died shot dead on stage. And I'm just a crazy fan, did a horrible thing, and I think he was up to his brother, which is the drummer of the band. So Dimebag and the brother played in a band called Pantera, which we were super fans. We have a special guest on that track called Atman, and it's Alex Kolnick from another great band from the thrash metal world called Testament. He improvised a solo.
Let's listen to Atman. So songs inspired by guitarists that inspired you, solo played by a guitarist, and a piece dedicated to another guitarist. Do other guitarists, what do they say about what you're doing? Here you are playing on these acoustic guitars, wailing on them. just the two of you. What do they think of that?
We've met a few of the guitar heroes, we play in New York, and we met Aldi Meola, went to our show without us knowing it. And then we spend a few hours afterwards talking to him. You know, they think that what we do is different to what you can hear nowadays, and we are happy that we can reach a certain level of popularity, so we can introduce these musicians to different people, and that we believe they can like.
Well, let's go out with a title track. It ends the CD, 1111. We understand influenced by Pink Floyd, although some reviewers are saying they hear Dire Straits there too.
Really? Well, I don't know if Dire Straits, but it is our tribute to Pink Floyd.
Questions on this one. There's a piano at the end. Why bring the piano in there?
My brother actually plays the piano there, and it was, I don't know, it was just this idea I had for, you know, to close the album, and it kind of suits the piece as well.
Did you have any qualms naming it 1111, given that, you know, you've got 11:11, and, you know, 9/11 has... Obviously, it's such a profound thing for Americans in particular. Any qualms that it sort of might invoke that?
It just really comes down to the 11 artists we pay tribute, but also that's a fact. A lot of people is being haunted by that number, 11:11. They look at the clock and they see 11:11.
Well, now you said, you know, you look at the clock and it's 11:11. There are a couple of clock superstitions. One is that if you look at a clock and it's 20 past... or 20 of the hour, that means there will be a lull in the room. And I swear, every time I do it, it's true that conversation is a lull. But don't people say that you should make a wish if you see the clock is 11:11?
I don't know. The stories, they go crazy. But we think it's an incredible phenomenon that a lot of people see those numbers. It's something going on there.
Something going on. Well, for you, it's 11 musicians. That's Rodrigo Sanchez and Gabriela Quintero, otherwise known as Rodrigo and Gabriela. Their new CD is 11:11. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.